This is Amy Hall and Greg Kokel, and you're listening to the Hashtag STR Ask podcast. This is the podcast where we take your questions from Twitter, and you use the hashtag STR Ask. It's funny how that works.
Yeah.
And then we answer it, and we, you know, 5 minutes, 4 minutes, somewhere around there.
10 minutes.
Somewhere.
Half an hour.
Depending on how complicated your question is, we try to keep it short.
Or how confused we are.
So here's a question from Jeff G. I have a family member that made a profession of faith as a young man. After college, he married a Mormon and is currently active in the Mormon Church. He reiterated that his profession was sincere, but I have concerns that he is not truly a Christian. Any thoughts on how to approach this situation?
Well, it's probably best not to look into the past, but look at the present. And because there are different points of view decided by other theological commitments about what is taking place here. One person will say, well, he lost his salvation. Let's say if in the moment he believes Mormon doctrine, he's not a Christian. That's because Mormon doctrine is not the same as Christian doctrine. It may come as a surprise to a lot of people. That's unfortunate, understandable a little bit to the untutored because the language is largely the same, but all the definitions are different. And so it's a completely different religion. A rejection of classical Christianity, indeed a self-conscious rejection of classical Christianity. Joseph Smith understood this. This was the point. So it might be that they lost their salvation. It might be that they never truly were regenerate. And that's what I said. Other theological commitments will determine that. The important thing is not to look at the past because all sides agree that if you do not believe in Jesus rightly, properly, if it's the wrong Jesus and the faith isn't a genuine faith, then you don't possess the Holy Spirit, and you're not in the Spirit, to use Paul's language in Romans 8, and therefore you're none of his. So this is the question. If you are, I think maybe a way to get at this is for the Christian man to address the LDS man, who is a friend or family member, I guess, and just say, if your view is true, and it could be, for the sake of argument, then mine is false. If you are a Christian, a true one, then I am not a true Christian. If I am a true Christian, then you are not a true Christian. But we can't both be Christians. And that's just a way of kind of setting the issues clearly so that we can figure out, okay, where do we go from here? You're not pointing the finger at somebody, saying that they're a non-believer, whatever. You're just saying, look, we got two different worldviews here. And they can't both be right. They're incommensurable at critical points. Now, I've written a piece on this that you can find in our archive. I think the title is something like, Is Mormonism a Christian Denomination? Or something like that.
Something like that.
Sound right? Yeah. And I'm not trying to adjudicate.
Just another denomination.
Just something like, yes. That. I'm not trying to adjudicate between one or the other as being the accurate take. I'm just asking if they're the same. And, of course, there's been a lot of posturing that LDS is just a version of Christianity when we know differently. And so do most careful thinking Mormons. Certainly Joseph Smith knew differently. And so what we're trying to do, what I do there is just try to say, here's what classical Christianity holds, and here's what portions of classical Christianity is directly and explicitly repudiated by Mormon doctrine, and here is what they offer in replacement of that. Well, so then now that you know they're two different things, now you can ask the question is, which one is the right one, if either? And that is the more productive conversation. Mm-hmm. If that conversation is obfuscated by, well, we both believe in Jesus, you know, so we must both be Christians, then you're not going to, it's going to be hard to get anywhere. Incidentally, if that comes up, because that's been raised by to me before by others who I know who are LDS, I have thought of a great way to respond. do you think Muslims are Christians? No, they're Christians. They're Muslims. No, they're not Christians. They're Muslims. Well, Muslims believe in Jesus too. In fact, there is more about Jesus in the Quran than there is about Muhammad. So they believe in Jesus. Why doesn't that make them Christians? The LDS want to say, we believe in Jesus, you believe in Jesus, we're Christians. Well, so do the Muslims. They believe in a different Jesus, a Jesus who is just as different from classical Christianity as the Mormon Jesus is different from classical Christianity. So that might be a way to get around that, well, we both believe in Jesus, as if just getting the J-E-S-U-S word into your doctrinal vocabulary is all that's necessary.
I really like that approach. I think that would be helpful. And I also like the idea of sitting down and just saying, why don't we just talk about what the differences are and start with that? And I think the biggest differences are the nature of God and also the gospel. And one thing
Nature of salvation.
Yeah,
what must they
salvation,
do to be
yeah.
saved? Right.
So one thing that you might find helpful is in their Gospel Principles book, which they use to teach people their theology in their Sunday school classes, there's a parable about the gospel in there, and it goes like this. So there's a man, and he owes a lot of money. So his creditor comes and says, you need to pay all your money right now. So then he pleads with them and says, I can't pay, I can't pay. And then Jesus steps in, and he says, I'll pay for that debt. Now, this is where our parable would end,
yeah,
right?
Right.
But their parable goes on, and what Jesus says is, now you owe it to me, and I'll set the terms for you to pay me back, and it will be difficult, but you can do it. That's where the difference comes in.
Right, right.
So that might be a good, he's sure to have one of those books, and you could look that parable up in there and talk about the difference between that.
Mm-hmm.
And then I would say, once you have all the differences kind of ironed out, that's when you say, okay, well, now what does the Bible teach?
Mm-hmm.
If the Bible hasn't been changed, you may have to cover that also. But
yeah.
What now, let's look at the Bible.
And this is a point where they believe in the Bible insofar as it's been properly translated. But, of course, every Christian believes that. I believe in the whole Bible. Even those lousy translations, doesn't matter. I'm still believing in that stuff. New World Translation, I still believe in. No, of course not. We don't believe in bad translations either. But this becomes a little bit, it's a shell game then. It's a cover for them to scoot to. So the question that's fair to ask Columbo style here is that, all right, what parts, by the way, before we get into this, what parts haven't been properly translated? Because we won't even have to go there. We can just tear those out of our Bibles. They use the King James Bible, right? I mean, it's a standard issue, LDS, King James. Right. What parts haven't been translated properly?
Well, and to get around that, you can use the Joseph Smith translation, which most of these things he didn't change. So you can say, well, let's look at his translation and see what he said.
Yeah, and they can't take exception with that.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So just like with Jehovah's Witnesses, you use the New World Translation. But see, when people say, well, as long as it's been properly translated, well, they're going to go right away to James chapter 1 to do their deal with, if you lack wisdom, ask of God, you get the burning in the bosom kind of thing. So they have no doubts that at least those verses were translated properly because they serve their purpose. Well, why can't we go to other passages? By grace you have been saved through faith, that not of yourselves, is a gift of God, not of works, lest any man boast, Ephesians 2:8-9. Why don't you go there? Well, I don't know. That's the Bible? Well, I don't know if that's been properly translated. Why would you doubt it? It's in your same Bible. Why don't you guys have a red letter edition, and you have all the verses not properly translated in red letters? Better yet, why don't you find all those places that you know are not properly translated and translate them right?
I think a lot of the time what they mean is transmitted when they say translated. So they think things were left out. They think things were changed over time.
Well, okay. Well, this is of course, I'm not sure about the left out part, but even that we could agree with if things are changed. Our conviction has to do with the autographs, the originals, not what's been changed. But this is why we have textual criticism. Mm-hmm. And so if there is something in doubt, and by the way, this is the way we deal with this just in our own field, you know. Look at the Jesus seminar. They're tearing all this stuff out. They say, oh, this, and so they get a low Christology. Okay, well, what do you think Jesus seminar is really authentic? Here's what we think is authentic. Okay, great. You go back to that, you still get a high Christology. So even when they limit it down, you could still deal with it. They limit it illicitly, as it turns out, but still, you've got something to work with. And I think is meant to discredit any kind of appeal to the Bible that is contrary to Mormon doctrine. And they go back to their own documents. And the irony is, we know that those documents have been changed because we have existing copies that are early and we have the ones that are late, and you can see the differences. This is the big inconsistency with this approach. Anyway, there's more that could be said, but
yeah, we have a lot of posts on our website about Mormonism, so I encourage you to take a look there. Mm-hmm. Drew Field asks, I'm taking my Sunday school class through the tactics video study, and there is some worry when it comes to Columbo 3. Specifically, is it a double standard for us to use Columbo against other people, but to, quote, stop the advance when it's used on us? And explain what Columbo 3 is first,
okay,
before you get into this.
Columbo 3 is when you use questions to make a point. And sometimes in order to make a point, you have a couple of different steps. And so you ask this question, then this question, then this question, then this question. And when you're asking those questions, you're kind of setting them up for just chuckling about something, I'll tell you in a minute. You're setting them up to make your point in an effective way. All right. And I qualify in the book in a non-abusive way. You're getting to the conclusion in a legitimate fashion. You're just getting cooperation for the other person to help give you the pieces that you need to get there. So somebody said, what about the problem of evil? So you do believe in evil, right? Yes, I do. Well, do you believe then in an objective morality, apparently? Yes, I do. Okay, now I got a couple of steps to the direction I want to go, but I'm getting it from them. They can't deny objective morality if they've already affirmed it, because I asked them the question about it. So, but sometimes you will find that it appears that somebody else is doing that to you. That is, well, you believe this, right? And you believe this, right? Then when you believe this, right, gotcha. That's where they're going. And you're not paying too much attention to the questions, and you're wondering if they, well, maybe I do kind of believe that, but if I affirm it, maybe I'm going to get in trouble. So I give a technique for cutting that off at the pass so you don't get yourself backed into a corner in an inappropriate way, okay? And notice I make the distinction in the book that Christians are to use this charitably, not uncharitably, to get to the truth, not to use it as a rhetorical tool to trap somebody else. Mm-hmm. But it can be used to trap you as well. And if you don't know how to get around that, then the best thing to do is to step aside, not let them do that. And I talk about that. Now, this is being called a double standard. Well, we want to use it to trap the other person, maybe they'll think, but we don't want to get trapped ourselves. That's a double standard. Well, yep. So what? Okay, so this, to me, this is like saying, this is why I was chuckling before, and you just have to pardon the you got to pardon the military metaphor here. So we're in war. Are you telling me that you want me to shoot at that other guy, but when he tries to shoot at me, I duck? That's a double standard. You're not saying he should duck. You want me to shoot him when he's standing right up, but you want me to duck? Well, yes, it is. Oh, double standard. Sure, but it's not relevant to anything about the point. Why should you make yourself inappropriately vulnerable to be taken down by an opposing view? That's all I'm saying here. That's a double standard. So what? In this case, the double standard is not a vice. Double standards are a problem when you're making a moral distinction, not a tactical distinction. That's why I brought in the military metaphor. If you're making a moral case, but you have one set of moral rules for you and a different set for other people in a way that inappropriately favors your side, that's an inappropriate double standard. But when you're jockeying around, forget about military. Let's take basketball. Wait a minute. You want me to dodge his attempt to block my shot, but you don't want him to dodge my attempt to block his shot. Right. I want you to score, not him. That's a double standard. Yeah, but so what? Do you see the point I'm making there?
Mm-hmm.
I think the confusion here is it's a tactical double standard, which is irrelevant to any moral concern. The problem is when you have a moral double standard, and then you're playing fast and loose with the moral facts, like a special pleading type situation.
And I also, I think you mentioned this briefly just now, but there are people whose purpose is to trap you.
Right.
That should never, ever be our purpose. Our purpose is not to trap people. Our purpose is to help lead people through the thinking so that they can make sense of the argument. We're mm-hmm. not out there to win a spectacular battle.
Right.
And we're out there to bring out the truth, to help them to bring it out of themselves so it's not just us telling them something, but they're actually thinking through it. And we're going towards a certain end. But it's not to trap them. It's not to humiliate them.
And not to humiliate. But we want to show that some conclusions are inescapable when you think properly about mm-hmm. this. So we're not in many cases, we're not going to leave them a way out if there is no way out. If this is the conclusion, this is kind of like talking to a jury, you know, and you're given all of the evidence. So you don't want the jury to say, well, maybe, maybe not kind of thing. You want to say, look at the, see this? There. That's the guy. That's not trapping the jury. That's showing the jury mm-hmm. that there's no other way out than this conclusion. That's completely appropriate.
Right. So when you're receiving the questions, you don't know necessarily that other person has your best interest in mind.
That's right. You don't know what the intent is. You don't know what ambiguities may be built into the questions that you're not alerted to yet. So all I'm suggesting here is to sidestep mm-hmm. that whole process. Mm-hmm. You take away the tactical advantage, and instead of saying just answering their questions, then leading you down a primrose path, you respond and say, well, you know, it sounds to me like you're asking questions to make a point. You know, I'm not comfortable with that. Why don't you just make the point?
Right. And if you're asking questions and the person isn't comfortable, then you don't have to do it that way either.
Exactly. If they did, somebody will say to you, what if they did that to you? I said, well, then I would just make my point. I would lose a tactical advantage, but I'd still make my good point.
Mm-hmm.
Wouldn't be as forceful as before, but I'd still make it. So I'm willing to play by broadly the same rules here. But I don't want Christians to be placed at an illicit disadvantage at the mercy of somebody who maybe doesn't have a deep respect for the truth.
Mm-hmm. Tom Gerg asks, a friend and I are having a discussion about being different from the world. What does a Christian family do to be different in this world? How do we look different?
There's a statement that Paul makes that has to do with missionary work that I think it, or the communication of the gospel. And he says, to the Jews, I became a Jew, though not under the law myself, I acted as if I were, so to speak. To the Gentiles, I became a Gentile. In other words, now I'm trying to think of exactly how the verse goes. I became all things to all men in order that by all means I may win some. Now, I think what Paul is identifying here is a similarity in morally benign cultural features, morally benign cultural features. He didn't become, I'm going to become all things to all men. The Gentiles, I'm going to go to the strip show. That's where they're going. I'm going to go. That's where you draw a line. And I do think there's some confusion on here because people will look at somebody that's dressed kind of like hip or extreme or hip hop or whatever, and they'll say, well, you look just like the world. And my response is, and who do you look like? You look just like the people in your social niche as well. You know, you're not dressed in robes. You don't have a special cap or a shawl on or whatever like that. Like some religious traditions have garb that identifies them as a religion. in some ways, precisely so they don't look like the world, I think. Some Christian sects do, S-E-C-T-S. And, but generally speaking, we don't worry about that. If I wear Nordstrom's shirts and Levi's or something like that and Nike shoes, I don't think it would be legitimate to accuse me of looking like the world because I'm dressing like the people in my cultural niche. So I think what we have the freedom to do is to adopt certain cultural trappings in our life and our behavior that don't themselves have any moral consequence to them, okay? And now, sometimes there is a moral consequence in the way you appear. So look at this. This is the kind of clothing everybody wears when they go out to a fancy prom. Okay, well, you know, everybody doesn't wear that thing, and that's drawing a whole lot of attention to areas that probably people's attention should not be drawn to. There's an alternative to still look good and nice and still be modest, okay? So even in the dressing clothes, there, you know, I think we can ask these kinds of questions. But the principal issue is whether there is a legitimate moral line that's being crossed when we are like them.
I'm going to take this a little bit different direction because I want to throw something out there. If you want your family to look different from the world, the quality that comes to mind immediately to me is humility. Jesus makes humility possible because without our knowledge of our sins being covered, what we have to do is make ourselves look good.
Uh-huh.
And we have good to point. Defend our names. We can't apologize because that's admitting there's something wrong with us.
Mm-hmm.
Well, because of Jesus, we can admit there's something wrong with us. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something that's hugely different from the world.
Mm-hmm.
We can be open about our sin,
mm-hmm.
and be unafraid of that. We can apologize. And the world will notice that you're not afraid to say that you've done something wrong and to apologize. And that's when Jesus gets the most credit for our lives, when people see that we actually aren't the best people in the world. Then they'll see that we're trusting in Christ for our righteousness. So I think if there's one thing I would say for your family to focus on, I would say humility.
Yeah. That's a great advice, Amy. And I was just thinking of this phrase, God is opposed to the proud, but he gives grace to the humble. I had it kind of on my little to-do list mentally to look that up because I think it occurs 5 or 6 times in Scripture, and maybe that many times just in the New Testament. I know it's in 1 Peter, but I know there's other places where it's at too, and it's a quotation from the Old Testament. And it's interesting to me that the same formula appears multiple times in the text. God opposes the proud, but gives grace to the humble. You want to have grace? Here's the cost. Here's the kind of people that God gives grace to. You want to have God as your enemy? Be proud. I think about that a lot because this is something that I have to deal with just as a human being, you know, and good counsel, Amy.
Thank you, Greg. Another episode completed. We went over a little bit, but that was an interesting question. All right, everyone. Thank you for listening, as always. Keep sending us your questions, and thanks for listening. This is Amy Hall and Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason.